I'm Matthew Boyd, producer of the documentary Project Frontline and chief commercial officer of Boyd Technologies, a contract design and manufacturing firm in the healthcare industry. We have a world-class innovation ecosystem here in our region, and amidst the countless tales of collaboration and scientific discovery that have marked our industry's response to coronavirus, it became clear that Project Frontline was only scratching the surface. So we're launching a new series called Boyd Biomedical Design Stories, which will feature in-depth interviews with experts and entrepreneurs working in the trenches of startups, healthcare systems, and academia. We'll cover early stage idea generation to product launch. I hope you will join us to learn about biomedical design and innovation, connect with peers, and get inspired. For our premiere episode of the show, we're joined by one of our industry's most prominent leaders, Brian Johnson, president of MassMedic. Brian appears in the Project Frontline documentary and shares his incredible story as one of the key people who were faced with managing the crisis in Massachusetts from the very early days of 2020. Today, we'll be talking about his work as a medical device entrepreneur, as well as his current role as the leader of the Medical Device Industry Association here in Massachusetts, and some of the incredible work he's doing there as the president of MassMedic.
For more than a quarter of a century, MassMedic has been the voice of the groundbreaking medical technology industry in New England, advocating for sound public policy that supports innovation and fostering a community built on a shared purpose, saving and improving the lives of patients everywhere through medical technology. Since the beginnings of New England's dominance in health tech, our members, the women and men who make up MassMedic, are researching, designing, developing, supplying, manufacturing, and deploying the next generation of medical innovations around the globe. The heart of health tech beats here in Massachusetts, and at MassMedic, we're proud to be part of that journey. Learn more about how you can join our community at massmedic.com.
Brian, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
So, you and I have talked a lot about your career and your journey to your position as a leader of our industry up to this point. And I wanted to jump in and start really right there. You know, you started your career in media and entertainment, sort of evolved to journalism, and then you saw an opportunity to launch a startup in medical device. From the early part of your career, are there lessons learned that you still carry with you today as a leader?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many lessons. I mean, I you know, I've had a passion for writing my whole life, and, you know, I followed that into my first career, into actually ended up working at 20th Century Fox in my first job out in Los Angeles. And I was a script reader, and it was an incredible experience working being in a movie studio and walking to work every day and seeing, you know, the Jimmy Smith saying hello to you every morning. You know, it's a 21-year-old kid. It was just really cool. We were next to NYPD Blue, and, you know, I'd see the cast of The Simpsons out at lunch, and it was just, it was an amazing experience. But it was also, you know, it's an incredibly hard industry to get traction in. So, you know, throughout sort of my experience in the movie business, I really, you know, whether I was being a script reader or a PA on a movie set or doing sound, you know, the most enduring lesson I learned was something a cameraman told me about 4 a.m. When I was, you know, kind of moaning about, you know, what am I, you know, how can I get ahead here? I keep sort of, you know, bumping into these roadblocks. And he just said, look, for the first 10 years of your career, it's who you know. You know, and then the second 10 and the rest are what you know. And, you know, it was a great lesson for me about networks, about, you know, in your career, your greatest asset is who you could pick up the phone and reach out to and who will take your call and who will do you a favor if you need it or who will step in and help out a friend. And I think that that's was the most enduring lesson I had besides sort of, you know, just always be open to doing what needs to get done and to never blame people. You know, we kind of developed this thing on a movie set where it was like, you know, okay, a mistake happened. I don't really care how it happened. How do we fix it? And, you know, those lessons have always stuck with me, and they've been really important to me in my whole career. And I think they've done me pretty well.
I mean, you guide and mentor and lead so many entrepreneurs in our industry. And I think that's one consistent theme I always see in your message is sort of grit and determination and putting in the work. I mean, this is not, our industry is not for the faint of heart. You know, you don't come in here for a quick win. What do you think, just sort of building on that, what do you think the, you know, for entrepreneurs listening to this, what's the one personal characteristic? If they're sitting, listening, thinking, do I have it? You know, should I do this? You know, what is it that they need?
I think entrepreneurs need a few things, right? The great ones, and, you know, I've been lucky enough in my career, I've interviewed, I don't know, dozens, maybe even into the hundreds of CEOs. The great ones are really competitive people. And they are driven by the need to compete. And it's interesting in how they compete, though, I think, because the really great ones don't compete to win. They sort of compete because they hate losing so much, they're going to do anything they can to not lose. And I think having that sort of spirit about yourself is very helpful as an entrepreneur. Not great sometimes at home, but I mean, I think I would say fear also. You know, in my career, fear of losing has been a tremendous motivator to work harder. Fear of looking stupid has been a really big motivator for me to put in the work. And I think that, you know, that those are all really important sort of characteristics that you have to have inside to be successful as an entrepreneur. I mean, there's a whole, you know, there's a gazillion tactical things you can do. But, you know, if you're not really driven by an intense desire, in competitive spirit, you're not going to succeed because, you know, at the end of the day, entrepreneurship is still a full contact sport. And, you know, there's got to be a winner and sometimes there's got to be a loser. And I think, you know, you don't want to be the one saying, I wish I had tried harder, or I wish I'd done something differently. You want to be the one, you know, sitting back and sitting up on a conference a dais and the keynote address talking about your career and acting like you had a plan all along.
Yeah. I mean, I think to some extent you can extrapolate that to any leader or manager in a business. Is I don't quite remember in my own career when the accumulation of failures became so apparent to me, or challenges. Maybe failures isn't the right word, but I think you develop that competitive spirit because you realize that every day you're going to be pressed with so many challenges, and we don't hear about those as much, you know, out in whether it's networking or in the media. But it's at some point you have to realize that those are really the expectation. Yeah. And so you go right. I mean, that's essentially what you're saying is you have to go in with this attitude that you're going to accomplish what you need to every day, no matter what.
Yeah, there's a great philosopher that I heard from once, and he said, you got to learn how to take an effing punch.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, you really got to learn how to take a hit and get back up. I mean, there's no greater quality to have for an entrepreneurship, or actually any sort of success endeavor, right? I mean, you got to learn, you know, it's not about, you know, getting knocked down. It's about getting up.
Yeah.
You know, and we can call them opportunities all they want. I've failed a lot. I have had heartbreaking failures in my career. I've lost dream jobs. I've had dream jobs offered to me and taken away. I've sort of seen the light a few times and, had it slip through my fingers. And, you know, every time it was devastating. And I thought, how am I going to get back up from this? But, you know, I just, you know, never quitting is, you know, I think one of the things that I really take pride in. You know, I never quit. I never stop fighting. And I'm, you know, I'm always determined to make, you know, if I have a setback in my career, I eat it, I swallow it, I try to own it. And I say, now how do we make sure that never happens again?
Yeah, and I mean, it's in the accumulation of overcoming those failures where you develop some confidence that you can do it again, right? And then I think you get to some point, hopefully in your career, where you feel like you can to kind of overcome anything. What's been most rewarding for you as an entrepreneur?
Well, it's a really interesting question because, you know, you go in, if you're not optimistic as an entrepreneur, you probably should quit right away if you don't think you're going to be wildly successful in your endeavor.
Yeah.
I suffer from delusions of grandeur as much as anyone. You know, everything I do, I think it's going to be like the most successful thing in the world. And then I sort of, I'm disappointed that it's not, it's not the greatest success in the world. And then I have to sort of, you know, get some perspective and realize, oh, actually, you know, when it all added up, that was pretty good. I'll say this, for me, and the most rewarding things are twofold. One is that I built a product that survived my leadership tenure, that has a life without me, that has evolved without me. And that's the massdevice.com, which I founded and built, that's still going really well and it's growing. And Device Talks, the conference which I founded, is still going and growing. And that's incredible. I think the best thing is really some of the people whose careers I helped shape. I'm really proud of the people who believed in me and took a risk and it paid off. I think that's incredible. I look at their progress and I feel like I can share in some of their success and glory, and I love that. It's really whose lives you've impacted, and that's to me the best part.
Yeah. My father said to me early in my career, if you're not excited driving in here every day, you got to find something else to do. And it speaks to the purpose-driven aspect of our industry, which I want to come back to later. But sticking with Mass Device for a second, can you take, what was your first vision of Mass Device? I mean, we're talking about a period of time. I was in business school, and there was maybe two of my classmates started blogging. And I mean, it was a totally different era. There was a classmate of mine was from some random company called YouTube. It wasn't that long ago, but it was a different world. I mean, what was your first vision of Mass Device?
I had built a sports blog, actually, and I had learned, I was kind of doing it just for fun, but I was really learning the business of building your own web community. I had been a journalist. I had worked for newspapers. I worked for the Associated Press. So I had all the chops and had known, how to be a pretty good reporter. I learned how to build an audience through this blog. And then I kind of realized, well, I don't think I want to be in sports, online sports journalism. That might have been a mistake, actually, because I didn't anticipate daily sports fantasy.
Right.
Stupid me. It really, really starts, in 2007, actually at the MassMedic Investors Showcase at the Park Plaza Hotel. At the time I was doing work for a consulting firm who was in med tech. And I was really, kind of helping them with business model optimization. So we were doing a lot of stuff around learning modules and, trying to grow a web business out of an in-person business. And so I got this ticket to the showcase and I heard all these, it was the first time I was ever exposed to med tech entrepreneurs and these incredible ideas that percolate among early stage companies. And I just felt like, who's telling this story,
Right.
I don't read these stories. I don't read about these cool instruments, these cool devices that are doing all this stuff. This business is really exciting, but it doesn't seem like anybody's telling this story in a really compelling and exciting way. And I actually went home from that show. I went and I bought the domain name massdevice.com, and I was just like, I'm going to build a Drudge Report of MedTech. And you know, that was the genesis of the idea. It was just like, I'm going to tell this story better. I'm going to do this. I'm going to apply the skills of good journalism to this industry, and we're going to tell the story about these devices. And I had one or two sort of unifying visions about it, right? One was, behind most of these technologies, there was a story of somebody's life being changed for the good, or, you know, somebody who was on a mission because somebody they loved passed away from a condition that they felt they could fix. And I thought, that's incredible. And if you can tie that human story to a tech story, that's a home run. And then number two, it was just going to be like, we're going to tell all the stories, and we're going to build, you know, it's not going to be opinion based. It's going to be straight reporting. We're going to build, you know, a big reservoir of content so that, you know, we basically document this entire industry. And, you know, for the past, you know, it's been around for, you know, 11 years now. And, you know, it's probably in total one of the most comprehensive histories of the medical device industry. It's really cool to think about it like that. You know, I used to think about, if we printed up all the pages that we have, it'd be a 50,000 page book. And I was really excited by that.
That resonates with me because I very much view our business and myself as, you know, an outsider coming into this industry. I think in a lot of ways, the medical device and the biotech industry can be viewed as these sort of black boxes of sort of insiders only game. And I think what you did with Mass Device is you changed the landscape so that people could learn about the industry as well. You know, learn about the companies, learn about the technologies, and gain access to it. And I think in the end of the day, to me, that the industry is better off for that because it's more open to entrepreneurship and innovation. And I think we're just starting to see that now in sort of this golden age of health tech. And
yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I can't agree with you more about this sort of like medical device and biotech are black boxes, right? I mean, first of all, there's the two most boring names for the two most exciting technologies right. in the world, right? I mean, this is the art of human possibility, you know, and we hide it behind these stupid, boring terms developed by people who had, you know, God bless them, they could invent, you know, incredible technology that'll keep your heart beating, but, you know, in terms of story and narrative, they suck. Right. And we have to wrestle the narrative away from the scientists in some ways right. on this. And that was I was always really steadfast in my belief when we started this at the end of the, you know, the 2000s was like, we're entering the era where healthcare is going to be the dominant issue of our time. Mm-hmm. You know, what we can do as human beings is going to change dramatically over the next 20 to 30 to 40 years. And, you know, I knew I wanted to be there on the front lines telling that story. I felt it was so important. You know, it was just a gut feeling I had. You know, thankfully, you know, I think I hit it pretty well. We had a lot of struggles. We had a tremendous amount of struggles. I co-founded it with a guy I went to grad school with, and we were very excited by the storytelling aspect and sort of the business plan aspect. And we were good writers, you know, we had to learn the publishing business, and right. that's a hard, hard business to learn. You know, I had to learn how to sell ads, you know, which was really, right. you know, it's about as unsexy as it gets in some ways, selling ads. But I mean, you know, it's actually a really honest sale. You know, you have to deliver, otherwise people will leave you. But it's, you know, it's something that we had to overcome, and I had to overcome personally, you know, to learn how to become a publisher as much as a reporter.
What's your take on where the business media landscape in our industry is now? I mean, you were a change agent, and I think a lot of things have changed since then. Where are we now?
It's a good question. We're in a weird place. I think, you know, when I started Mass Device, I knew how to get an audience. I knew what I had to do to get an audience. I knew, you know, how we had to do it. I had a good idea. Tastemakers were still really, I think, really important in online media then. So, you know, it was all about who's linking to you. And then, you know, social media comes in and really, in my opinion, screws the game up completely for content creators. You know, on one level, it creates this very easy opportunity for you to create content and to sort of drive awareness. But on another level, you know, it drove everybody from building our own worlds to just coming to somebody else's world and giving them all of our content and all of our talent. And for what, right? I mean, you know, some Google ads, the economies of scale there are just tremendous. You have to get millions of readers in order to really make money. I just think, you know, I miss the days where we were all kind of building our own voices and building our own worlds, and you had to go to URLs and,
right.
You know, maybe I sound like an old fuddy-duddy at this point, but I'm not sure how you could build that today without sort of relying on, just giving up a great deal to sort of the viral aspect of it. You know, nothing goes viral by accident. I mean,
right.
It's all very intentional world, and it's there's still a lot of creativity in newsletters, which is great, and I like seeing that. There's a lot of voices. I do think that, there's a lot to be desired, though, in terms of the journalism that's out there. You know, I think in some respects, we drove too hard towards single source stories. I mean,
right.
We really haven't, by speeding up the news cycle so much, we did lose some quality. That's an eternal struggle for our industry, though, in terms of journalism, right? And I mean, balancing the need to get on the record and be first with the need to be thorough. You know, we, at Mass Device, we tried to thread that needle, but we did pretty much land on the side of, you know, let's be the most thorough. Let's have the best context in our stories.
Why'd you decide to exit? Why? How? You know, how'd that happen?
If I'm really being honest, about four years into the endeavor, I realized we built a hell of a product, but we didn't build much of a company. I kind of let culture just happen, and I wasn't intentional about it, and I didn't love the culture that we had created. I didn't love driving into work every day. I mean, I knew what we were doing was good. I knew that people cared a lot about it. I wanted to keep it alive. Our growth was pretty good, but we had plateaued a little bit. But really what we had done, and it's kind of a disruptor's dilemma or something, which is, you know, when you change the game, no matter how big or small the game is, right? So if you're a small disruptive force, you have to then be ready for when your bigger, more funded competitors copy you.
Right.
And that's what happened to us. We basically built a blueprint. We showed the entire industry how to cover this from the trade sort of side. When we started this, it was only trade magazines. Nobody was covering the news part. And then we watched, you know, new entrants come in, and then we watched the big guys, the really, really big guys, companies that were hundreds of times our size, starting to mimic our style, starting to sort of follow our lead. And, you know, I was concerned that we couldn't compete in terms of defending the turf that we had won. So I knew I had to find some way to either raise a lot of money or to build up the defense or sell the company. And, you know, as I was doing that, then we were approached by an acquirer who made, you know, a great deal for us. And, you know, that was wonderful because, you know, what we could do then was focus on building, you know, building this thing right and finishing the business plan. So we sold it in 2015 to a company called WTWH Media out of Cleveland. And they said, you know, we want to build, we want to build a series of trade publications underneath your news brand, right? So we want to preserve the great things you're doing. And then we want to build this, you know, these sub brands under you. And we want to take the Device Talks brand and make it into a big conference. And we want, you know, we want it to really shine and be sort of the flagship of our, you know, publishing business. And that was a really cool opportunity for us to sort of bank the risk, to cash out, and then to finish the business plan. And so, we took that opportunity, and it was the right time and the right exit. I think the most important thing that I learned from that whole lesson, right, is like you have to script your exit just as much as your entrance. There has to be a stop and a start to things. And another lesson I learned was really founders have a real shelf life, in my opinion. You know, the founder is, you know, it depends on what kind of founder you are, but like for me as a founder, I was really great at building. I was really great at sort of being the driving force behind the conception, the vision, you know, making people believe in something and working really hard. I lost a lot of interest when it became about, you know, when we had, you know, after I had tripled the sales, tripled the size of the thing, you know, coming back to do it again, to double it again in another 2 years. I mean, there was nothing exciting about that, honestly, for me. Like that, I couldn't gin up the, you know, the passion for that. So I'm a builder. I'm not really somebody who's going to be a, you know, a defender. And you know, you just got to know yourself.
Yeah. All right, that's a perfect segue. We're going to take a quick break and actually watch a clip of you from our documentary Project Frontline. And when we come back, we're going to dig into your current role as the president of MassMedic.
It's not until the NBA cancels their season on March 11th that Corona or COVID crosses the chasm into full-blown, you know, holy crap moment. And then March 13th, they pull the plug. You know, no more school. So when school gets canceled, right, then we all know. And then the March 13th, I remember that night, Brookline Public Schools said 2 weeks. Marty Walsh said 4 weeks. I looked at my wife, I said, why do I feel like it's 9:30 a.m. on September 11th right now?
All right, welcome back. Brian, I want to jump into your path from entrepreneur to turnaround CEO. You know, you successfully started Mass Device, and now you're leading MassMedic through this tremendous period of growth and transition, really, which I think is interesting because the function of MassMedic is really public policy and advocacy for your membership. Which is very different from entrepreneur. I mean, what made you decide that this was the next step in your path?
When you sell your company, a funny thing happens. You get a boss. And you go from not having a boss to having a boss. And, you know, at first it's great because you have support and things like that. And then, you know, I think at some point, you know, if you're an entrepreneur, you're always an entrepreneur, so... you know, I was starting to think about what comes next, and I actually was approached, you know, like right before Christmas in 2017 by Tom Sommer, who was the president of MassMedic, who I'd known for a long time. And he, you know, he asked me, he told me he was retiring, and I said, well, congratulations, that's wonderful. And he said, you know, I said, do you want me to suggest some people who might be a good fit for a successor? And he said, well, what about you? And I said, like, are you crazy? Why would I? And, you know, at first I was kind of like, what? And then I was like, I started to think about it, and I started to think about what Massmatic really meant. I was intrigued by the opportunity because I, you know, as a reporter, I kind of look at it this way. You know, you can, they'll take you up to the boardroom door as a reporter if you're good. But once they go in the boardroom, those doors shut, there's no way you're in there. And, you know, I had grown very fond of the industry covering it and then being a publisher in it and sort of developing these relationships with these people building these companies. And, you know, I found myself, especially because I'd done a ton of work on the medical device tax, because I just felt like the medical device tax was the stupidest piece of public policy that I'd seen in a long time. And like, I, you know, that was an odd thing for me as a reporter, you know, but I just said, so, but I said, you know, listen, I think it's dumb in my sort of in my heart, but I can't just say it's dumb. I have to sort of find the proof that it's not working. And so, you know, I think a lot of sort of my advocacy chops I learned when I was actually studying the medical device excise tax, which is, you know, was a pay for the Affordable Care Act. So it was just a blanket 2% tax on the sale of any medical device. And it was just like your classic stupid policy where it was a regressive tax. It unfairly punished, you know, small companies. It, you know, there was, and it didn't, you know, at the end of the day, it didn't even collect enough revenue that it said it was going to collect for the federal government. So it was essentially just completely penalizing companies. And, you know, excise taxes are used for cigarettes and guns, and so it's sort of like a sin tax in a lot of ways. And, you know, that got me interested in sort of fighting for the industry, right? And I just, it just seemed like a really interesting opportunity. I thought this association's been around for so long. It's really helped define med tech in Massachusetts. You know, I'm a Massachusetts guy. I grew up here. I love Boston. You know, it's my home. It's a place that I want to spend the rest of my life. I really believe in what we do here. I've totally drank the Kool-Aid of Massachusetts and Boston and New England. And I just thought, you know, maybe there's a way to make a trade association really important and hum, right? Like, you know, I know what we think of a trade association, right? I mean, you think of country club fees to eat stale donuts and drink coffee, you know, or you know, breakfast meetings and things like that. And I just thought there's totally a better business in here. This is a really cool business problem that I could try to sink my teeth into. And I just felt like, I think I can do that. I think I can find something really exciting about that. And the thing that was most interesting, though, was the exposure to leaders, right? And to get a chance to interact and engage with congressional leaders, Senate leaders, state leaders, and really be the voice of the industry and translate what I thought was incredible about this industry to politicians. And, you know, all that has been really, really fascinating and interesting and fun. And in some ways, it's some of the most exciting work I've ever done is been working here at Massmatic. I mean, I love the challenge I have every day to make this organization relevant and important, you know?
Yeah. I was just thinking as you were speaking, I have to tell you this story. So when Tom Sommer was leaving Massmatic, we went out to lunch and he said, you know, there's a new person coming in who's going to lead the organization and you're going to love him. He's got a digital background and it's going to be great. And I sort of said, okay. And then I went, you know, whatever, a week or two later to New England Healthcare Executives Network meeting. And it was they do a meeting in January after the JP Morgan conference. Oh, yeah. And a reporter was the keynote. The reporter, I won't say who it is, but they stood up and they gave a report and it was all biotech. and he had no report on anything medical device. And then Brian Johnson stood up and dropped the mic on the meeting, and you basically just said that is unacceptable. You really did. I watched people's faces in that room. I turned to my head of sales who was with me, and he said, "This is going to be great. He's going to be our guy." And I really think that you've lived that. And I mean, it was a bold sort of introduction to that little networking community. But I think that you've taken the baton and really changed in Boston, you know, in our industry, how people are talking and thinking about what we're doing. So I had to mention that.
Yeah, that was fun. He was.
I didn't say specifically what you said, but you really dropped the mic in that meeting.
I dropped some cursing. Yes. But I believe. This is the most, in my opinion, you know, up with sort of space travel and, you know, this is like the coolest tech in the world. And the idea that we should ever be, feel like this is unsexy,
right,
is absolute horseshit. And the thing that drives me crazy about it is we listen to reporters, you know, and some people who, you know, they have this inability to sort of see why medical technology is incredible. And look, I love biotech. I think biotech's amazing. But biotech is a molecule. Biotech is a compound. What they've done is the biotech industry has captured our imagination because we are all focused on the cure.
Yeah.
Right. We want to cure cancer. We want to cure, you know, disease. But, you know, that's awesome. But it took mRNA 40 years to have its one night in the sun. Like, and you know, cures take a long ass time. And you know, I'm not going to live to see a lot of cures in my lifetime. Yeah. But you know, medical devices, medical technology, that's what's keeping us alive. That's what keeps us going. That, and then, you know, all the other stuff, robotics, wearable monitors, understanding and tracking human activity and understanding what our bodies are doing it's amazing to me. And you know, I can't stand people who talk about this as if it's a boring industry. That's why I say, like, get rid of the damn term medical device, please. Like, yes. It's so stupid. It doesn't make any sense. Like, we're creating the solutions to problems that you know, have plagued humans forever. And we're doing it through technology. You know, we're putting machines in people's bodies that live inside their bodies for decades. Like, that stuff's incredible. And, you know, I love it. I think it's the most exciting place to be. I think this right now in Massachusetts, this is the best time to be part of this industry that we will ever be a part of. And anybody who tells you any differently is just obtuse. I mean, frankly, and it's not, there's no, honestly, is there a delineation between biotech and medtech? Only in our tiny insular world where we're sort of, you know, bucking our heads against it. Or we are arm in arm with biotech finding solutions for human problems.
Yeah, one of the biggest growth areas, right? I mean, the crossover of drug-device combination products.
Look at COVID, right? COVID is the perfect narrative. And we had to stem the tide until we found a vaccine. Okay, there's medtech.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Then we found the vaccine. Okay. And that's gonna quell some of the problem. But guess what? That vaccine's not gonna help you years from now if you have damage in your lungs or, God forbid, in your brain or any other lasting effects of having contracted COVID. That's med tech again. So, like, you know, It is a perfect marriage.
And all the things that have changed. I mean, how are clinical trials going to be run? How are patients going to be monitored? I mean, all of those medical devices facilitate biotechnology and pharmaceuticals and everything else. Yeah. So I'm biased, but you've provided tremendous support to our organization. And I've, you know, just being a member of the association, you see that, and you feel that. And I think one of the best examples of that is the Ignite program, which is your accelerator, which I think is an oversimplification of what it really is. This is a new take on Ignite and, yeah. and the accelerator program. You know, what's your vision there?
So startups to me are the lifeblood of our industry. I love startups. I love founders. I love their courage. I love their naivete. I love the audacity of thinking that you can change, you know, the world, right? I mean, I just think it's almost like a renewable energy, you know, and every time I get, you know, worn down, I meet a startup founder and I get inspired again because I feel that juice. Ignite was started actually in 2004. And it was a great program, had a lot of impact, helped build some really cool companies, and it ran for 10 years. And then it was on hiatus. And then when I got the job, I said, that's the first thing we are relaunching. Because I knew, like, you know, startups are the key to getting this into this sort of trade association, its future. I mean, it has to be startups because, I mean, if you look at it, you know, Boston Scientific has more employees in Minnesota than in Boston. You know, I think these multinational companies that have a big presence here, we definitely need them, but we have to grow our, you know, this is an R&D climate. This is an innovator's city, an innovator's region. So we're ecstatic about Ignite's progress. We're on our 50th company. You know, our companies have raised more than $40 million in the last 2 years. We have a heavy emphasis on entrepreneurs of color and women entrepreneurs. And, you know, we're trying to impact the next generation of med tech founders just through, you know, through love. I mean, it's like, you know, we also give them a little bit of money if they we have some prize money. But we're going to build this up into an institute of med tech innovation. And it's going to be something, you know, I think looking back in 10 years, this will be, you know, the legacy of my tenure at MassMedic is that we built this incredible Institute for Medical Innovation.
But I can say even from last year's cohort to this year's, it just is so impressive. The founders and the companies are so impressive. And what happens throughout the program of the master classes, the way that you guys are supporting de-risking of regulatory and technology and even, you know, the entrepreneurial lessons like team building and getting those things right, because there are so, I mean, my MBA is from an entrepreneurial school here in Boston. I went to Babson. MedTech is just littered with areas to fail when it comes to startups. I mean, it's just, there's so much risk, just reimbursement, you know, all of these avenues. And I think what you guys are doing to support these startups to go through these master classes and get into the market is incredible to be part of and to watch. I'm excited to see where it goes, because I think if last year to this year is any indication, I can't imagine where it'll be in 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine where some of these companies will be in 10 years. You know, but you said it, man, the first $500,000, I mean, that is the death zone for startups. And medtech startups are the hardest companies in the world to start. I mean,
there's no
besides
question.
Maybe like, you know, renewable energy companies. I mean, or like, you know, I think that they're, it is full contact entrepreneurship. And it's like with pharma and biotech, it's actually kind of a binary dilemma, right? Does it work or does it not work? In med tech, you know, there's like three or four of those hurdles where it's like, even if it works, even if it's, you know, it could find a market, even if it's perfect. If it doesn't, you know, if it doesn't get the right reimbursement, it's dead. So, I mean, it's like, it is the most hurdles. It is extremely heavily regulated, and it's paid for by a third party. Oh, by the way. So, I mean, this stuff's really hard. So if you can do really early intervention, if you could teach these people at the outset, this is what it's going to take to get to where you want to go, I think you'll have an impact. And then also the secondary goal is, you know, you're actually your venture. The most important thing about your venture is you. I know that you think your technology is the greatest thing in the world and your technology is going to change the world. Guess what? It's probably more than likely or not, that technology is going to fail. This company is going to fail, but you're not going to fail. And, you know, if we invest in you, not your company, you know, maybe not this round, but the next round, you're certainly going to succeed at some point here. Either, you know, it might take two, it might take three.
Yeah.
But if you as an entrepreneur understand and believe that you're the product, that's a really powerful tool to learn very early on in the process.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to jump into a little more just about the industry at large, where we are today and you know, what's next for health tech.
Boyd Technologies is an advanced materials and technology company operating in the medical device and life sciences market. We're experts in regulated single-use devices and liquid media solutions. Our growth platform provides a full suite of services for design and development, advanced manufacturing, and fulfillment operations. To learn more, visit us at boydtech.com.
All right, Brian, in closing, I want to just kind of dig into the moment in time where we are, you know, in medical device and the future. I mean, we have just been through something that I'm not sure has really, I'm not sure whether people are just sort of moving past it and leaving it lie where it is, or really kind of digesting it and it'll be interesting to see where we go in the future. But I mean, do you think we have seen structural change that is here to stay in the industry?
I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I think, just to allude to your first point, I think for better or worse, we're done with the pandemic. I'm not sure the pandemic is done with us.
Right.
But, you know, I think it's very, very much people are moving. They've hit their limit. They need to move past it. And it's very understandable. You know, what we've been through as a society is the damage is untold, right? I mean, because there's no way to get perspective. There's no way to get perspective on, you know, 600,000 dead, likely a million. You know, there's no way to visualize that, you know. And there's no way to go through what we just went through as a world, you know, and all the ways the pandemic has changed us, and to really contemplate that. I think, you know, hopefully we spend some time over the next few years really thinking about what's changed because of the pandemic. I don't know if that's going to happen. I think we're going to try and blow through it. So in terms of structural changes in health tech, you know, I think one of the things that I think is really interesting, and we'll see if the FDA, you know, wants to keep doing it, is the emergency use authorization method of getting devices and technologies onto the market is a really interesting regulatory framework, you know. And I hope, you know, some of that sticks around. I think it could be really useful. I mean, I'd love to see some of the, you know, I'd love to see some of the collaboration continue. I'd love to see our government continue to be interested in what we're doing here. You know, I think they learned pretty quickly how important this industry was. You know, hopefully they remember that. And hopefully there's no, you know, silly backlash against people and the companies that saved this world. But you know, I mean, things, this is how it, societally things change during a pandemic. And, you know, I think, we're going to have to just kind of wait and see where all the chips kind of settle. But, it's, you know, I know it's changed me. That's for sure.
What, I mean, you just mentioned, the FDA and, I just wanted to, I don't want to get, you know, too political, but I mean, what's the role for the federal government in terms of, you know, the future, for the industry? What are the right, I mean, I've heard people refer to it as kind of, you know, guideposts to guide the industry, but you know, there's things on all sides, right? Like, is it a good idea to suspend, you know, intellectual property rights, versus like EUAs, like you just mentioned,
Yeah, no, 100% is not a good idea to suspend intellectual property. I think it's an absurd notion, frankly. You know, I mean, if you spent decades of your life developing, you know, the mRNA vaccine, and they did, the scientists that developed it spent decades of their life doing it when no one believed in them. Sacrificed, you know, tons of probably family hours and things like that. I mean, I think you deserve to be rewarded when your technology, I don't know, saves the world. I think it's, there's something good about that. Something right about that. What's the role of the federal government? The federal government should be to create sort of the structured rules of the playing field. And then I think, you know, get the hell out of the way for the most part, right? Make sure that the technology meets the safety and efficacy guidelines, right? And then I think the federal government also needs to create a better way to pay for these devices. I mean, I think, you know, we have a problem with reimbursement in our country. It's really hard. It's really hard for technologies to get the appropriate reimbursement. I'd love to see more effort put into making that a little more you know, predictable. You know, we don't have to make the rules easy. They just have to be predictable. And I think that's always been industries, especially medtech's ask of the feds. It's just like, tell us what the rules are. Provide us with the lines that we have to stay within, and you know, we will deal with it. But don't be unpredictable.
Yeah.
And so I think that's where really their role should be to provide a predictable set of rules and guidelines that people can follow.
I think the other area that we've explored a lot with the documentary, which I'm sure you agree with, but is the federal government's role in early stage research and development, right? So like basic research funded by NIH, you know, DARPA, applied research, you know, in partnerships with, you know, corporations or hospital systems. We have such an amazing combination of that here in Massachusetts and in Boston and Cambridge. And I think that's one thing that gets lost in the sort of discussion about federal government is, because that stuff, you know, is, you know, if it's basic research that helped advance mRNA technology, well, it happened 30 years ago. Yeah, yeah. And that gets lost in today's dialogue when you're talking about, you know, the production of the vaccine.
Yeah, the federal government's role, I think, really is to provide funding for innovators to try and solve big problems. I think it works pretty well. I would like the government to fund 1,000 different solutions rather than try to sort of do it on their own, do one solution. I think it's right. I think it's a more effective tool for creating innovation ecosystems. And I think that's really super critical, is that we have these innovation ecosystems, you know, and you know, I think that's what we have that's so unique here, right? Is all these different entities that are, you know, striving in the same industry to break boundaries. And it's, you know, I wouldn't tinker too much with that formula. It seems to be working frankly.
Yeah, yeah. It does feel that we're in this golden age in biotechnology, in medical device technology, and you know, in health tech, as you say. You know, as we go forward, what are the key areas that you look at as, you know, that there is going to be, you know, such significant change and growth? You know, what are the most exciting areas of the market?
Robotics and robotic surgery, robotic platforms for healthcare are probably the most exciting because they take 5 or 6 different technologies and then kind of mold them into one. I think the pandemic made us realize we have to take some bit of the human out of the hospital. You know, the hospitals were not designed for pandemics, and you know, we realized that pretty quick. So we need to accelerate accelerate robots working side by side with us in healthcare. It's the most exciting because it's the combination of all these different technologies come together into one seamless sort of solution. And I think that that's incredible. But we are in the golden age right now of life sciences. And we're sitting right now in the middle of that. You know, there is something like 11 million square feet of lab space getting developed in the greater Boston area. That's a lot of lab space. I was saying to somebody the other day, I was like, we're probably going to be bringing in about, you know, 5,000 to 10,000 jobs just in sort of health tech, med tech alone over the next 5 years that are going to pay an average salary of, you know, about $150,000 a year. That's, you know, if we bring 5,000 jobs into the state with making it that much in terms of starting salaries, I mean, that's going to have a huge impact on our economy.
Yeah.
And then if you add to that what's happening in biotech and biopharma, and then you know, all the other areas that touch that, I mean, you're looking at Boston becoming primarily a life sciences city first, and that is paradigm shifting for this region, because we're the birthplace of the mutual fund, we're the education capital, right? I mean, this the coolest part about Boston is the history of reinvention and how many times we've been the world's leading provider of a certain thing that just kind of drifts off, right? Life sciences, though, I think we're gonna keep life sciences. I think everybody is aligned around that. So I couldn't be more excited about the trajectory of this industry.
Yeah, it's great segue, because we're gonna leave it there. And in closing, we have an exciting announcement. I'm really excited about it. We're gonna collaborate with you and co-host some episodes of Biomedical Design Stories with MassMedic. What's your vision of that? I mean, what are you hoping we accomplish as we go into this?
Well, I hope we can tell the stories that matter about this industry and this time. We just talked about how this is the time and place for life sciences, and I think I want to document that. You know, understanding that we're living in one of those periods that, you know, maybe they'll talk about in 100 years, right? You know, the Gilded Age, or, you know, Paris in the 20s or something like that. You know, maybe it's not as romantic, right? But, you know, that we could be sitting right now in the epicenter of where we're going to change the limits of human possibilities. And we could be, I think we are sitting right in the heart of it. And so what we hopefully can do is get some of those stories down, so maybe future generations, they can look back on it and have a record of what we've done.
Yeah, it's really exciting. I mean, we've tried to capture this documentary of this crisis over the last year. And I think probably the biggest thing we've realized through that process is how many stories there are about innovation and the work that's going on that go far beyond just the crisis response. I mean, that was an incredible story in and of itself, but I think you're exactly right that there's so much to showcase and talk about, and I think it really does matter in terms of the education of other entrepreneurs, the inspiration of people to get into the business, and to document it, you know, like you're saying, for posterity. So, Brian, thank you so much for joining us today and partnering with us on Boyd Biomedical Design Stories with MassMedic. You can find Brian online at massmedic.com and on LinkedIn. Brian and I will co-host our next episode, which will feature Bob Coughlin from JLL, formerly the CEO of MassBio, and Travis McCready, also from JLL, formerly the CEO of Mass Life Sciences. We're going to be digging into the innovation ecosystem here in Massachusetts.